Good afternoon. Well, folks, here we are smack in the middle of summer with the great vacation month of August just around the corner. From what I hear, it's going to be a busy season. On the Cape, along the North and South shores, and all the lake and mountain resorts report heavy bookings. If you haven't made up your mind about where you're going, you might like to see the 110-page booklet recently put out by the Maine Development Commission. It lists hundreds of sporting camps, farmhouses, big and small hotels, trailer camps, and golf courses, with information about rates and how to get there by bus, plane, boat, train, and automobile. I presume other New England states have similar listings. But this is the first complete catalog of vacation spots I've seen this year. You can get a copy by writing the Maine Development Commission at Augusta, Maine. I don't know, of course, how you folks are planning to spend your vacation, but Alice and I just came back from 2 weeks in the country. And this time, I laid away the camera, typewriter, and notebook, and instead of dashing around interviewing people and getting stories, we took it easy. We loafed, looked, and listened. And I'm amazed at the things a man can see if he just sits quiet on a log in the woods or gazes into pond water from a good, comfortable rock. We met a Boston businessman who wishes to remain anonymous, who for the first time in his life did those very things, and he had a wonderful time. He almost blushed as he said, "If the boys in the office could see me lying on that ledge, watching a big bass guarding his nest, or that old sucker scooping up white perch eggs, they'd think I'd gone crazy. I never realized there was so much to see in the woods." By getting up while the trees were dripping with dew, he filled his lungs with clean, cool, spicy air. By being out early, he heard the full-throated songs of birds he never knew existed. On a stroll after supper, he got a good look at a red fox. And as he came back through the still, dark forest, he surprised a doe and her two tiny fawns. One day, he told us, he almost stepped on a mother partridge with a brood of chicks. The old hen spread one wing as if it were broken and staggered around so he would follow her, which he did, until all the little partridges were safe in the underbrush. Then she flew away. He said, "That's what I call being smart. She fooled me completely." Another day, it rained hard, so he left the canasta crowd and joined the gang in the boathouse where the old-time guides were gabbing about log drives, bears, deer and moose, and the big fish they used to get before the sportsmen took to automobiles and airplanes. You know, deep in the heart of every man who has ever flicked a fly across a pool of trout water, there's a lifelong desire to someday find a secluded spot that's never been fished. Millions are spent each year on fancy fishing tackle, outboard motors, canoes, guides, tents, and whatnots by sportsmen who have the fond hope that this year they will find the stream of their dreams. I know men who work their heads off 50 weeks a year waiting for the 14 precious midsummer days when they can put on their old duds and tramp through the woods for the sole purpose of wetting a fly. In winter, they console themselves with nature magazines, reading about other guys who found the virgin pools and brought back a creel full of big ones. I heard such a story on this recent trip from an old and experienced guide. Here's how he told it between puffs on his old briar pipe. "About 8 years ago, when I was guiding a party, we got lost for a short spell, and I climbed a hill to get my bearings. I knew there was a fair-sized lake down below us, and I saw that the beavers had dammed up the brook, making a pond about 4 acres. Between the pond and the lake was a likely-looking fishing spot, and when I got back, I asked Charlie if he'd ever fished there. He said he hadn't, so I dropped the subject. But that fall, when I was up there gunning, I took a good look, and in that beaver brook was the biggest mess of trout I ever seen. They were spawning, and the law was on, and anyway, I was hunting. So I waited till spring." He stopped, filled his pipe, struck a match, puffed, and went on. "I intended to go back there, but the war came, and I didn't get to it. Then I got a letter from some fellows, the right kind of fellows, you understand, wanted to know if I could guide them to a place that hadn't ever been fished. Well, it was rugged going. We had to use a wagon and tote the canoe about 3 miles through the woods. We got on the pond just before sunup, and we used small spinners and worms. Every man in that boathouse was on the edge of his chair. The old chap puffed on his pipe and continued in a matter-of-fact tone. There was a big pointed rock that stuck up out of deep water, so we paddled and let our troll lines drop into that hole. Bango! Something hit and bent my 7-ounce rod till the tip touched water. Then bango again, and all the other rods went down. The first one I netted, the guide said, was about 19 inches long and weighed 3.5 pounds. And he was the handsomest brook trout I ever see. Being trapped in there where the beavers had churned up a lot of food, them trout couldn't help being fat. And from the small size of their heads, I knew they was young. By now, he said, they must be whoppers. And the best part of it is, nobody has bothered them. I'd like to be up there today. You haven't been back there? We all asked at once. No, he drawled, I ain't. But a few weeks ago, I sent some fellas in there with specific directions. That is, I told them there was three things they must do if they wanted to get fish. You could have heard a fish hook drop as we waited for the climax. They found the place after a couple of days beating through the brush, but they didn't get a bite. You see, all them trout are big by now, and they're down deep in the spring holes. And those fellas failed by not doing one of the things I told them to. He tapped his pipe on his boot and surveyed the eager circle of faces. And then, as if reading our minds, he said, with a slow, sly grin spreading over his lean Yankee face, I'd tell it to get up there before too long. Maybe you'll be reading about it in the newspapers. Every man there would have given his right eye to get a chance to fish in a place like that. But no invitation was forthcoming. And if I know the typical Maine guide, no amount of money could induce that old fella to divulge his secret pool. I asked the Boston businessman what he thought of the guide's story. Fascinating, he said. Absolutely fascinating. And a few hours later, I saw him studying a big geodetic map of the Maine woods. We spent the second week of our vacation at lovely Lake Keezer, and there I saw more brown trout breaking water than I've ever seen before in my life, and they were big babies, too. But when they're rolling on the surface, they won't bite. My friend the Johnsons from Verona, Pennsylvania, went out with veteran guide Paul Adams from Severance Lodge one day and brought in 3 4-pounders. And the next day, they landed a 7.25-pound beauty. If anybody knows where the big fish are in Keezer Lake, it's this Paul Adams. And he told me his success was also due to three things. He trolled deep with a leaded line, down 100 feet or more. He used Big Davis spinners hooked on backward, why, I don't know. And most important of all, he went where the fish are. I believe if you're going to do serious fishing, it pays to have a guide who has all the answers. But after all, no man can be sure of getting the big ones all the time. But the records seem to prove that when strangers from the city go into the country, a guide will generally help them bring in the best ones. But I've done an awful lot of good fishing down there, right along the shore and out in a boat all by myself. A lot of Maine ponds and lakes have been stocked with brown trout in the past 10 years, and they're just beginning to pay off. On light tackle, a 5-pound speckled brownie is good fun. And I know one pond where a 12-pounder was landed a couple of weeks ago. As I've said before, this Lake Keezer country is the most photogenic inland scenery I've ever found in New England. The rolling fields, carpeted with buttercups, daisies, and the devil's paintbrush, come out grand on Kodachrome. And the purple hills and spectacular mountains, mirrored in the glassy water, are what photographers dream about and seldom find. The foreground is all in Maine, but the background is the beautiful White Mountains of New Hampshire. And that reminds me that I haven't told you about the White Mountain pancakes that they serve at Severance Lodge. The chef, and he's one of the best in the business, pours out a great gob of batter onto a smoking griddle. When the pancake is golden brown on one side and light as a feather, he flips it over and cooks that side. Then Bill Hodges steps up and spreads on a thick layer of pure Vermont maple sugar mixed with rich country butter. Another hot pancake goes on top of that, and a second layer of maple sugar is applied. Then the third crispy golden brown pancake is laid on top, more sugar, and the whole delectable mass is topped with whipped cream, making it resemble Mount Washington covered with snow. When you sink your teeth into that combination, as served at Severance Lodge, you've had the last word in desserts. And I might add that at the famous Sunday night suppers, served under the trees on the shore of the lake at sunset, a different, thinner kind of flapjack is offered the hungry guests, smothered, if you please, with lots and lots of rich, creamy lobster nuber. Ah, boy. Well, getting back to more ordinary country dishes, we had some wonderful fish chowder at Judge Power's camp on Panther Pond. I'm very fond of white perch chowder, and a mess of pan-fried perch with baked potatoes, biscuits, and cold, crunchy cucumbers makes a good meal, as Alice will tell you. We had a grand time together out on the pond, just before sunset and after. And the full moon came up, and that's the best time of all to troll for white perch. In between times, we watched the swallows, which did return to the little house we provided for them last year. You know, I told you about that a couple of weeks ago. Since I gave that bird broadcast about old April, the fish hawk at Vinyl Haven, and the eagle's nest at Warren, we've received letters from all over about birds nesting in unusual places. Some wrens built their nest in a pair of trousers hanging on a clothesline, and the owner left them there until the little ones had hatched. A contractor refused to use his bulldozer because some birds had nested in the toolbox. And from Rockland, Maine, comes a story of some very bold robins. Mr. Leon White strung a lot of rags on a wire to scare the robins out of his strawberry patch. The robins took the rags to line their nests and then ate all the ripe strawberries. And then they felt so darn bold, they swiped the food from the cat's dish on the back step. The prize letter that came in about birds reads as follows. Dear Blackie, when I heard you telling about the swallows trying to get into that battery box, I remembered an incident I witnessed some years ago in Onset. Across the street was a cottage with fancy scrollwork, and for years the sparrows had nested there. Our neighbor boarded up the scroll to keep out the birds. They fussed and fluttered and chattered away in great indignation. One morning, the letter continues, we heard a woodpecker tapping up near the roof, and upon investigating, we saw he was working on the place the sparrows wanted to nest in. After a few days, the woodpecker had an entrance big enough for them to get into. They built their nest, and the landlord allowed them to stay. The letter concludes, I can't say whether that scroll work is still there, but I can show you the house where this happened. Yours very truly, Mrs. Eva Carlton, 104 Main Street, Fairhaven, Mass. Can any of you folks beat that for a bird story? Figuring I might be able to entice some of the birds at Panther Pond to come a little closer, I nailed a board between two pine trees, spread some crumbs and peanut butter, and on a projecting limb, I draped a well-dried donut. In the morning, the crumbs were untouched, but the donut was gone. Alice hung out another one. The next morning, half of that had disappeared. So we strung a wire between the trees, and from it I suspended the piece of stout fish line, and on the end, we hung the other half of the donut. Late that afternoon, we saw the culprit, a beautiful big gray squirrel. He ran up the tree, sniffed, found he couldn't reach the swinging delicacy, so he leaped, grabbed it, and started up the tree. But when that fish line brought him up short, he was the most surprised and maddest squirrel I ever saw. He pulled and yanked and scolded, then the cute little critter went back, held the donut with his paws, and with one bite severed the line. A few seconds later, he was high in the tree, munching his donut and dropping the crumbs on the folks who thought they could fool him. Well, we watched the birds and squirrels and fed worms to the fish, listened to tall tales from the woods, and came back feeling like Henry David Thoreau. And we ate White Mountain pancakes at Severance Lodge. We hope you folks have a grand vacation, too.